and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at Japanese director Akira Kurosawa again, and looking at his 1952 classic, Ikiru. Returning on the show today to talk about Ikiru is Professor Mike Giuliano. Professor Giuliano, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So this is the second time I'm watching it, and this is like, this film is definitely such an emotional film, and it feels like such a gut punch at the end when you just go through this character and his the last 6 months of his life, and just you and all the story of how the bureaucracy treats him. It's just such an emotional movie. I mean, I've seen it twice, and every time it just gets me.
Well, it's very much about a 60-year-old Japanese bureaucrat who learns that he is dying of stomach cancer and has perhaps 6 months to live. And so the whole film becomes a reflection as he thinks back on his life, and also then after he passes away, the film itself still has a lot of running time to go. He dies, but the film still has a lot of running time to go. And so if in the first half of the film we have the principal character reflecting on his life, the second half of the film really is very much after he passes away. The people in his life, particularly the people working in his office, they think back on him, they reflect on him. So the film is very much structurally composed of flashbacks as much as present-day footage.
Yeah, it is an interesting narrative because he does, you know, he's the protagonist, yet he dies. And so the rest of the film is almost like Citizen Kane-ish, where you have all these people putting, you know, together what the, you know, why he did what he did. And then, you know, as they put more and more pieces together that, you know, that they were in this self-denial, it's like, oh, well, it was everybody. It was like, no, it was really him. He was the one that pushed for this measure to get done.
When the film came out, and certainly in the years since then, it's often been observed that this film is very similar to Citizen Kane in terms of a man at the end of his life and that flashback reliant structure. And in fact, Kurosawa was asked about that on various occasions, and he was always very quick to point out that when he was making Ikiru, he had not yet seen Citizen Kane.
Oh, wow.
At that point, he would have certainly known of it. He would have heard of it. And it was a little surprising to me because he really was very, very smart when it came to American films, but for whatever reason hadn't seen it yet. He saw it later. Taking that as his statement, one can't really say that he was inspired by Citizen Kane. In retrospect, it seems that way, but at the time, he had yet to see the Orson Welles film.
That's interesting. So the reason why he didn't see that, was it because of, you know, American films during World War II in Japan at that time, or was it something different?
It would be conjecture on my part, because Kurosawa would have seen many American films, obviously, before the war, and then after the war, there was quite a backlog of American films to catch up on. Perhaps, and this is just conjecture, perhaps he hadn't caught up on that one yet. But think about it. You know, during the war years, they weren't watching any American films, and then when the war ends in 1945, it's a tremendous backlog of films, and of course, Citizen Kane from 1941. So there was a lot of catching up to do in the late 40s and early 50s. So presumably, it's just simply he hadn't gotten to it yet, but he did get to it later, and he could see the connection, but in point of fact, would not have been directly inspired by it.
You know, another American film that a lot of people call this film, which I want to get your opinion on this, because this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It's, a lot of people call it the Japanese It's a Wonderful Life, and I just think those, I mean, they're sort of looking back at somebody's career and finding their worth in life, yes, but they could, the two characters couldn't be any more different to me, because the character of George Bailey, he's done so much, but you know, it's all him realizing that he's done so much that, you know, that if he didn't exist, that terrible things would have happened. But in this film, it's he, you know, the character of Watanabe, he hasn't done anything in his life. It's all about him trying to do something finally in his life. So I just feel like I don't quite get where that's coming from. I was wondering if what your opinion on that is.
Well, it's a very slender point of comparison, simply that you have two troubled protagonists who are facing life and death issues. But as you say, their characters are so different. George Bailey has had a wonderful life, and he just needs to have somebody pointed out to him.
Yeah.
And it's crucial that George Bailey, you know, will live in the end, right? It's a happy ending. After all, it's Christmas, too, and you have angels coming down. It's a very sweet way to end the film. And I'm not saying that in the pejorative sense. It's a terrific film. But the whole sensibility is so different there, whereas in this film, Akanji Watanabe, is not only dying, we just know he's going to die. Even if you're seeing the film for the first time, it doesn't seem like a very healthy prognosis. You feel like he's on his way out. He's reflecting, what can he do at the very end of his life to in some ways redeem it or give it value? So it does have a kind of humanistic warmth, certainly. It's a happy ending in that sense, but a very qualified happy ending, because after all, he's dead. He's no longer there to mm-hmm. enjoy the happiness. Mm-hmm. And then moreover, it's a very somber film in a lot of ways. Not that It's a Wonderful Life doesn't have that darker side to it, but I think Ikiru is a much more ruminative film in the sense of being deeply depressing at times. And you know, Kurosawa does not give us easy victories there, mm-hmm. Whereas Capra, of course, with Capricorn, has a greater sense of humor and of affirmation and of cheerfulness, even though It's a Wonderful Life is certainly his darkest film in so many ways. But as I say, ultimately quite light and bright by the end.
Yeah, if they were going to name this film, it would be called It's a Depressing Life or It's a Sad Life.
Well, that wouldn't sell many tickets. If you put that on the marquee, people might not be inclined to go. And after all, though, when you think about it, the literal translation of the film title Ikiru is to live, and so there is definitely that humanistic affirmation, as I say, mm-hmm. and you know, I don't want to slight that at all, because the film really does make you want to live. It doesn't want to make mm-hmm. you get stomach cancer and die. Yeah. It wants you to really live. But if you are dying, it gives you a chance in some ways to think mm-hmm. about ways to redeem your life or to finally do something of lasting social value. And that's something certainly, you know, for us to talk about, the ways in which this individual character relates to a larger society.
Yeah, and definitely. There's one quote I like to read from Roger Ebert, who in his review of Ikiru, he said, "I saw Ikiru first in 1960 or 61. I went to the movie because it was playing in a campus film series and only cost a quarter. I sat enveloped of the story of Watanabe for 2.5 hours and wrote about it in a class where the essay topic was Socrates' statement, 'The unexamined life is not worth living.' Over the years, I have seen Ikiru every 5 years or so, and each time it has moved me and made me think. And the older I get, the less Watanabe seems like a pathetic old man, and the more he seems like every one of us." And that's such a great quote, just because this is a film everyone connect to. Even, like, I'm only 23 years old. I'm far from a midlife crisis, but even I can kind of connect to this and, you know, just realizing, have I done something worthwhile in life, or have I just sort of wasted it? You know, everybody can examine that question, whether you're 23 or even 73.
Well, it's one of the great films in that respect. It's on that short list. I would put it with Federico Fellini's 8.5. Where are you mm-hmm. in your life as you watch that film? The Fellini film, its principal character is a film director who has a midlife crisis, a mm-hmm. creative crisis. Is he creatively dead, if not actually dead? And so in many ways, he's on the verge of a breakdown. Now, if you're less than 43 when you watch that film, it's like maybe a midlife crisis to look forward to. Mm-hmm. When you hit that age, how do you feel then? How far have you gotten in life? And then what happens when you come out the other side of it? Ann Hornaday, the film critic at the Washington Post, has written about that. It's one of those resonant films. Where are you in your life as you watch it? I think Ikiru is similar in many ways, because you tend to think about, is this the future I have to look forward to? Or do I reach that point, and how do I react to it? And since we have what could be called dueling quotations, I'll throw back sure. I'll throw back two quotations your way. The first comes from Kurosawa himself. At the time he was making the film, he said, "Sometimes I think of my death. I think of ceasing to be. And it is from these thoughts that Ikiru came." So in many ways, he already, as he was into middle age, was thinking about such matters. And bear in mind that when the film came out in 1952, existentialism was gaining power as a philosophy. And if you think about Camus and Sartre and so on, people were thinking along those lines. And the film is oftentimes discussed in that context. So the second quotation comes from a writer, Richard Brown. He puts it this way: "Ikiru is a cinematic expression of modern existentialist thought. It consists of a restrained affirmation within the context of a giant negation. What it says in starkly lucid terms is that life is meaningless when everything is said and done. At the same time, one man's life can acquire meaning when he undertakes to perform some task that to him is meaningful. What everyone else thinks about that man's life is utterly beside the point, even ludicrous. The meaning of his life is what he commits the meaning of his life to be. There is nothing else."
Yeah, exactly. And I think even at that meeting, and you can see at the end when, you know, they act like, well, we're going to, you know, carry on his legacy, but they really don't because they're in that bureaucracy. And the mayor's, the city mayor, he's like, oh, it was everybody. It wasn't just him. And in fact, he didn't really do that much. But you realize he's got that playground built. And, you know, the women's council that were first originally pushing for that, they recognize him, and the city and the citizens recognize him. So I think his legacy is built, what he did with that. And regardless of what those people in the bureaucracy think of, his legacy is set, and what he did will always be remembered.
But again, it's a somewhat muted happy ending, because even though his life has been redeemed and he will be remembered, and the playground is getting a lot of use, there are mm-hmm. plenty of children playing on it, and his own family, his own son, can appreciate what the father's done. That's all on the upside. But on the downside, to some extent, is the fact that his co-workers and the mayor, the people in town, they acknowledge he's done something good. But by the same token, when they say, well, they're going to do good in their lives, they'll be reformers and so on, it's almost like that sort of New Year's resolution where, with the best of intentions, you say how the next year will be so much better in your life, and you're finally mm-hmm. going to exercise and go on that diet and this and that. Mm-hmm. And then what happens a few months into the new year?
You forget about it.
You forget yeah. about it. And in fact, you see that happen in the film. People in his office immediately are pledging that they're going to reform their lives and improve the city. But even by the end of that one scene I'm thinking of, they've already started to backslide. Mm-hmm. And you realize, well, humans may have good intentions, but they're often weak or lazy or just don't have the follow-through. And Kurosawa wants us to know that it's not like an entirely happy ending. Humanity is deeply flawed. People don't follow through on their good intentions and on all the speeches. They make a lot of speeches about how they're going to do mm-hmm. better, but then you see that they're not doing better.
Yeah, it's sort of like when you run into an old friend, like, hey, let's meet up again sometime. This was fun. You never do.
Well, no, that's the whole thing. That's the coded language. We should get together sometime. Usually means no time at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like yeah. the New Yorker cartoon where the guy's on the phone, you know, and he's trying to put off a business meeting. And the guy says, no, you know, Thursday's not good for me. How about never? Is never good for you?
And, you know, the whole statement about the bureaucracy, I mean, I love that because it's funny, but also very sad. Like when the montage, when they're sending these women all around, he's like, huh, well, you said it has hygiene. Well, that should be with this department. Or they just find any loophole to get out of it, so they just send him around. And then it comes back full circle to the place they were at the beginning. He tells them to go back to somewhere else. Now, do you feel that with that, Kurosawa was making something of a little political statement about the conditions of post-World War II Japan?
It's a very big statement, actually. This film was made, you know, less than a decade after the war, and it's a twofold condemnation. It would be too easy, too glib to say that he's condemning the American occupying forces because they haven't done enough to make Japan a true democracy, not just in the American model or mode, but a true one. When one of the women complains and says there's no democracy here, is she complaining about the Americans? Because after all, 1952 was the year that the American occupation ended and the transition of power began, putting Japan back in Japanese hands. Kurosawa does not let anyone off easy here. Namely that, you know, if the Americans are implicated, and there's a lot of American pop culture in the film and pop songs like Too Young and so on, particularly when he goes out for his night on the town, the dying bureaucrat, so much of that pop culture, so much of that nightclub entertainment, if you will, is American in nature. Mm-hmm. So the Americans are certainly implicated in what post-war Japan has become, but the Japanese do not get off easy. there's something entrenched about Japanese bureaucracy that's traditionally Japanese. So Kurosawa there is condemning that Japanese element. In fact, in that respect, I wanted to share a quote from one of the best film scholars of Japanese film history, Joan Mellon, in her book, The Waves at Genji's Door. And she puts it this way: the subordination of the individual to the group upon which all Japanese bureaucracies, governmental and private, are structured is seen by Kurosawa as preventing humane responses to the needs of those whom these bureaucrats were supposedly constituted to serve. And then she goes on to talk about specifically this particular bureaucrat, Watanabe. So Watanabe is very much a man within a system that does not respect the individual. Everyone is subordinated to the group, and the group itself is always passing the buck. They're always saying, well, you need to go to this department or mm-hmm, that one.
Yep.
We have a pile of paper on our desks. You need to take this particular piece of paper and go to some other department. They, in turn, will send you to yet another department. You'll be moving. You'll be going through revolving doors all day long, and nobody will accept responsibility. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to pass it along to some other department, and they'll have a rationale for it. So her quote there was, of course, you know, implicating a really very traditional Japanese structure, which is very much about the group and not sufficiently treasuring the individual, what you can do and what you should do as an individual. That's the existentialist argument. Mm-hmm. What about you as an individual? And then she goes on to write about Watanabe as an individual and what he needs to do or what he decides to do to finally redeem his life. And she says, quote, "In order to become a human being, he must cease to be a Japanese bureaucrat."
Exactly. And especially when he has that new, when he comes back to work, he's fighting the bureaucrats every chance he gets. I mean, you know, they keep like, well, go there, go there. And he's sitting there waiting. He's not taking no for an answer. And even when the Yakuza boss, because he's encroaching on their territory and they're threatening him with his life, let us saying, you know, don't, you know, step off. And he's just smiling at them. And then, you know, he is definitely defying the bureaucracy. And I do love that, like, last part of the movie.
Well, think about the mise-en-scene in the office where Watanabe, as the boss of that particular department, is obviously at the head of the table or the head table, mm-hmm. and the underlings off to the sides there. And they have very little communication one to the other simply because the piles of paper
yes.
are so high. Nowadays, the computer equivalent would be you'd have a lot of computer equipment sitting around
yeah.
your block, you know, computer screens blocking you from other employees. But here it's literally piles of paper. But I love the moment when he's at his desk, and he opens the desk drawer, and in the top drawer, he has an old document. And the translation of it is that 20 years earlier, around 1930, I think, it says on the document title page that this was something he wrote, he put together, that was reform-oriented. Somehow, paraphrasing that this was a document where he was proposing reforms for his department, you know, progressive, mm-hmm. let's do something and let's
yeah.
do something right. And what's significant there is that it's been tucked away in the desk drawer and it's got a string wrapped around it. It's been tied up. So it probably was tied up like that in 1930, which is the date on the title page, right? When he unties it, at that moment you think, well, maybe he's finally going to reread this and do something about it. But in that particular scene, when he's still very much the Japanese bureaucrat, he takes out that title page, puts it on top of the desk, but then he uses it almost like he'd use a tissue. He uses it to wipe off his fountain pen. So at that moment, he's not quite there yet. But at the point where he's had the diagnosis, he's sick, he's determined now to finally do things right. When he gets back to that same desk, that mm-hmm. same office, he has a goal. He has an orientation at that point. And his colleagues, his underlings really, are so puzzled by that. That's why there's so much gossip and so many rumors.
Oh, yeah.
Is he okay? What's wrong? What's he doing? And then that spreads sort of citywide, if you will, because it's so unusual to have a Japanese bureaucrat step out as an individual and try to do anything. You would think people would, you know, go along like, well, a playground's a good idea. Let's go for that. But it's so much outside of the norm. And that's the Japanese norm. That's not the American imposed norm. That's the Japanese norm that it's against.
Yeah, and when you're talking about just, you know, how the bureaucracy and like that ridiculous amount of paper, and I love that final shot when, you know, it's the one guy who actually does seem like he wants to make a difference, who was inspired by Watanabe, and at the end when he thinks that they are going to change, but when he realizes that, no, it's just more of the same, and he just sinks, and his face is buried under all that ginormous stacks of paper.
It's a great shot because you see it in the guy's face. He really meant well. He's sincere, but then he's just overwhelmed and dejected, mm-hmm. and his body literally slumps. You're right. And when it slumps, there's such a big pile of paper that he's half hidden by it. And Kurosawa has the smarts there just to hold the shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting film technically because it does have some of Kurosawa's trademark mobile camera work. It's got some very inventive camera work and editing, a lot of very inventive editing, actually. But by the same token, he also oftentimes within the office in scenes like the one you're referring to, he will just let the camera sit there, and the actor's body language tells you everything mm-hmm. you need. All you need is that actor's body language and a big pile of paper, and you've got your mm-hmm. shot, and he knows just to hold it. Don't mess with that. Just hold that shot.
Yeah, but and then you talk about mobile camera movement. I would say the one really good mobile shot is when he's at like the bar or the saloon or whatever it is, and everybody's having a good time, they're playing the piano music, and he wants that one song heard, and he's singing, and it's very somber, and this place that's just this real kind of rowdy party place, everybody just stops, and you can just see them all looking at him, and they're completely moved by his singing.
People have wondered sometimes why it's such a long film, and it's 143 minutes, and seems to really indulge every thematic concern. But that's really crucial in scenes like the ones you're mentioning right now. When he goes out for what amounts to an extended night on the town, it really is in a kind of real-time way. And then, as we mentioned earlier, in a sociological sense, you see him cutting through so many layers of Japanese society and how much of that is directly influenced by American pop culture. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of hybrid society at that point. So back to your earlier point, if the film is condemning Japanese society, it's a mix of the American occupation and its influences with that more traditional Japanese culture, which is still there and modernizing in its own way. And as I said before, nobody gets off the hook. You know, no one really gets a pass on this. I think Kurosawa is condemning all of them in a lot of ways. By the same token, when he goes out for the night on the town, finally he can have a good time or attempt to have a good time. He's not Mr. Party Goer exactly. And when he finally gets, because he lives this very isolated, even though he's got his son and daughter-in-law there, he's got this kind of very isolated existence, literally like going from the office to home and back again, and, you know, kind of a dull existence in many ways. And what has he done with his life? All those philosophical ruminations. And so finally to have, you know, a friend or friends who would like sort of take him out on the town, that's an eye-opener for him. For him to go into a nightclub, for him to sit around. I mean, you know, sad to say, he's finally realizing ways in which he might appreciate or enjoy life just as it's leaving him.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're talking really about the bureaucracy with this, you know, the giant stacks of paper. I know one film, because I saw this before I saw Ikiru for the first time, was Brazil with Terry Gilliam. And now that film was definitely a lot more comedic and mocks the bureaucracy in a way you can laugh at it more than, you know, not be philosophical. But that's one film that does that and really reminded me. I definitely feel that Terry Gilliam saw this film when he was making Brazil.
I don't know if, in fact, he did, but I would assume he probably would know Ikiru. I mean, it just seems like something that he would know, but I don't know, in fact, if he was thinking about it. But the films are very different in a lot of ways because Brazil, as you point out, is so over-the-top satirical at times, and it's got a sense of gleeful nastiness to it in places. It's really a very different mood. It's a very different sensibility than what Kurosawa brings to bear here. Because although Kurosawa is extremely satirical, it's a very serious satire. I mean, there are some funny scenes in it, but for the most part, it's a very serious satire.
And I was wondering if I could give your opinion on one of the scenes. It's once again, it's at the end, and they're remembering. They're talking about how he didn't even back down when the Yakuza was threatening his life. And there's that one scene when he's smiling. It wasn't the chubby guy that was originally, but the other guy that comes in. I think he's the head boss. And they just have this look at each other. And the guy, and he, you know, Watanabe's smiling because he doesn't fear death. And the other guy looks at him, and he just gives this recognition, a little nod, I don't know. And then he walks away and leaves him alone. I was wondering what your opinions on that, because a lot of people were talking that on the internet, and there were some people saying that he recognizes that he has cancer, or maybe even the Yakuza boss himself has cancer, so they realize that each other are sort of at their end.
Well, what's interesting is that Watanabe pretty much keeps his cancer diagnosis to himself. In fact, certainly keeps it from his own family. And most of his co-workers are likewise just left to gossip and rumor and, you know, we wonder what's going on. So although it's hard to say this in a definitive way, the scene you're referring to may be that at some level, some unstated level, the Yakuza boss may well have intuited, but we don't know for sure there, do we? We can only speculate about that. But I think what's readily said, what's said with more confidence, is that I think the gangster, if you will, looks at this bureaucrat and ordinarily would not be intimidated by a bureaucrat or, you know, wouldn't be impressed by him particularly. But I think he realizes at some point Watanabe has reached the point where, as his life is ending, he's taken on this task with a kind of missionary zeal and nothing's going to stop him. You know, he's just going to see it through. And I think, and this is my reading of it, I think that even a tough guy gangster would acknowledge a certain strength in the other guy at this point. You know, there is a kind of head-nodding respect that he would have for him there. And again, there's not enough by way of dialogue to really prove something like that. It's more a matter of how we tend to read character. But I just think that, you know, he realizes the other guy is a worthy person, you know, and even if they're, you know, not seeing eye to eye on something, he's got to respect in some ways the fact that this guy in his own way is very strong.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. You can definitely see it when he has those close-ups. And yeah, so I guess I would agree that, you know, it's sort of a nod like, hey, you know what? Let this guy do it. I respect him for fighting us and, you know, not backing down.
I mean, sometimes in a neighborhood, gangsters will be that way with, there might be a shop owner who's particularly belligerent and protective of his property and so on. And you might say, well, they're just going to bump him off, but not always necessarily. Sometimes in a gangster story, it's like, well, that's Mr. So-and-so. I mean, you know what? You know, we're on opposite sides of the issue, but you know what? He really believes in what he's doing and where he is and in the good of the neighborhood and all. And the gangsters in their own way sometimes want to do things for the good of the neighborhood too, don't they? They sometimes have a, maybe not quite a Robin Hood urge that way, but you know what I mean? They're looking out for their people. And if there's someone in the neighborhood who really has, you know, strong attitudes and you know, really believes in things, almost the way like the, you know, the priest in a town or somehow a merchant who's really respectable, that there's a kind of honor, a kind of respect that can be there. And I'm saying this in a very conjectural way, but it seems to me that they may have realized, well, here's this bureaucrat, and you know what? You know, we could, if we wanted to, obviously just push him aside. You know, we have the muscle and all. But, you know, at some level, we have a measure of respect for somebody like that. It's whether it's for, like, the town's priest or some literally, you know, missionary-type character or a businessman who means well or a bureaucrat who wants to provide, you know, the people with a playground or something. Yeah. I mean, even bad guys sometimes have their good days or their good impulses.
Yeah, it's like, come on, just give let them have the playground, you know?
Exactly. Why not? Come on now. We're still making money. We're okay. No, it's not killing our business. Yeah. Let them have a playground.
Yeah, we can bump off other people. It's not
other people. There are always other people to bump off. We don't have to bump him off.
You just mentioned a good point. You talked about Seven Samurai, and we talked about how Seven Samurai. We talked about how he uses the weather in a lot of the other scenes. In this film, once again, he uses the weather powerfully, and it's in that famous shot that you know, it's snowing. The playground's been built, and he's on the swing, and he's gonna freeze to death. But he's just happy. He realizes that, you know, he's finally done something in his life, and he's singing that song again that he sung at the bar, and he's happy. And it's a really powerful scene. I mean, that's the scene that whenever you buy it on DVD or want to get a poster or whatever, that's the scene they show.
The excerpted shot is always Watanabe on the swing going back and forth. It's an incredibly powerful scene. And again, as a film director, you're master of the universe, and so you also control the weather. And Kurosawa is really good about that. Think about the way in which he uses rain, for instance, whether in Rashomon or Seven Samurai, or here, you know, using rain or snow or the natural elements. He'll do that all through his career, really, whether in his Samurai pictures or his contemporary pictures. He's always thinking about what weather, in effect, what environmental conditions somehow would themselves be a kind of commentary on the character's internal states, their mental condition.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I haven't brought up or forgot to bring up that you want to talk about now?
Well, I just think one thing that bears reinforcing is the fact that Kurosawa's career is curious, because we tend to immediately think of him for the samurai movies, and how can you not, with Seven Samurai or late in his career, Kagamusha, Ran, and so on, all the collaborations with Toshiro Mifune, you know, that involve swordplay. But with that actor and his other great longtime actor, Shimura, they made not just samurai pictures, but they did a lot of contemporary stories. And Kurosawa oftentimes would alternate from one to the other, really from year to year even.
Yeah, and I think here, watching his crime movies, I thought he was extremely underappreciated as a crime director, as far as Stray Dog or Drunken Angel or High and Low or others. He's really good at crime movies. I don't think he quite gets the credit he deserves for that.
He's starting to, because Criterion and some other DVD distributors are starting to repackage and reissue some of the earlier Kurosawa films, and those include some of the crime pictures you're talking about. So I think actually people are becoming more familiar with that, in some cases discovering or rediscovering the crime pictures that these guys were doing in the late 40s and through the 50s. And so I think increasingly people will realize that as genres go, that was a principal genre for him.
Definitely. Okay, so I guess my last question I'll have is just tell us how you would bring this film into your Japanese film course.
only indirectly, because it's not one of the films we watch, but I mention it specifically to reinforce the point I was just making, that Kurosawa, again, you know, tend to think of, you know, we watched Rashomon in that course, we will watch Dreams. But you tend to think of Kurosawa primarily, or at least initially, in terms of the samurai pictures. But then you get an actor like Takashi Shimura, and he's in those films. He does the samurai pictures, but he also appears in so many of the contemporary films, whether gangster or otherwise, and that's how Akira would be mentioned, namely that the same actor was so versatile, as was his director, he could easily go from one genre to the other and back again.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Japanese director Akira Kurosawa and his emotional classic, Ikiru. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Giuliano, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it.
Okay. For the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying how tragic that man can never realize how beautiful life is until he is face to face with death.